A new report shows Wisconsin's prison population is rising. More than 23,000 people were in prison in the state last year. Officials expect that number to rise to as much as 25,000 by 2021. That's according to a report from the nonpartisan Wisconsin Policy Forum, which says one of the main drivers may be Wisconsin's truth in sentencing law. Cecilia Klingel is a criminal justice expert and an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School. Cecilia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure to be here.
Well, can you talk about the trends we've seen in the number of people in prison here in Wisconsin over the last decade or so?
Sure. Like most of the nation, Wisconsin saw dramatically escalating prison populations throughout the 1990s and early 2000s. We did see a leveling off of populations for a few years early in the 21st century. It looked like maybe we would reach an equilibrium point, but unfortunately, we're beginning to see upward creep again. And recently, as you mentioned, hit a new all-time record for the number of people in prison.
So it was going down for a bit. Now it's going up. Do we have an idea of why?
There are a number of factors that drive prison populations. So the most important thing to remember is that prison populations are a result of two things: the number of people coming in and the amount of time they stay. You alter either of those and you change the size of your prison population. And not only do we have new people coming in the front door of our prison system, but we also have people staying for a long period of time. And importantly, we have individuals who are exiting the prison system still on forms of community supervision, who are then often re-entering our system as well.
Yeah, let's talk about that extended supervision system. We used to have a thing that people are familiar with called parole. That's not really a thing anymore. How does extended supervision work, and what can lead to somebody getting back into prison?
Sure. So extended supervision functionally looks like parole while you are being supervised. The difference between the two is that when we talk about parole, we're usually talking about a situation where a judge has imposed a maximum sentence on a person, and then a parole board decides to let that person out of prison before the sentence is complete, and they serve the remainder of the term of supervision in the community. Under Wisconsin's truth in sentencing law, sentencing judges now impose a two-part sentence on individuals who are going to prison. The first part is the amount of time that person's going to spend in prison, and really, there's very little change in that. There's little opportunity to reduce that length of sentence. And then the second part is what we call extended supervision. It's still a period of community supervision, but it's imposed in addition to the earlier imprisonment part of the sentence. It's not a reduction of it.
WPR News spoke to David Liners. He's with a religious nonprofit that advocates for reducing the state's prison population. That group's called Wisdom. Here's some of what he had to say about this extended supervision program.
It's a real trap that people wind up spending just incredible amounts of time. It just kind of gets layered on top of each other, these rule violations.
So somebody's on this extended supervision. They've served their sentence. They're out in the community, as you say, but they're being monitored and supervised. What kinds of rule violations could lead to them going back to prison? And how long, I guess, could they be sent back to prison for?
So I'll answer the second part first, which is that when a person is on supervision in the state of Wisconsin, let's say a gentleman is serving a term of 5 years on extended supervision. If he screws up and violates the rules of supervision sufficiently that the Department of Corrections decides to revoke supervision, he can go back for the full 5 years, regardless how long he has spent successfully in the community. So whether that happens at year one or year four and a half, 5 is going to be the maximum term for which he can be sent back. We don't give what we call street credit to individuals on community supervision. We once did, but after truth in sentencing, we have not done that any longer. The kinds of things that get people sent back are complex. Sometimes it is an obvious infraction and a serious one. The commission of a new violent crime is a pretty black and white situation. Others are more complicated. Sometimes people will abscond, is the formal term we use. They just don't show up. They kind of go hiding for long periods of time. That makes it hard to supervise people. Oftentimes, it can be an accumulation of other kinds of violations, repeatedly not engaging in drug treatment, using substances repeatedly, getting in other altercations, failing to report in ways directed by agents, things of that nature. There's actually a wide variety of rules people have to follow, any one of them, as a matter of law, could get you sent back to prison. Usually probation or community corrections officers, rather, are making discretionary decisions about when to pull the plug, so to speak, on community supervision.
Cecilia Klingel is with us from the UW Law School. We're talking about an increase in the number of people incarcerated in Wisconsin, in Wisconsin's prison system. Let's ask a fundamental question. A lot of people are talking about, okay, we need fewer people in prison. Some people would say, well, wait, imprisoning more people is going to cut down on crime. They're in prison because they should be there. Do we know? Does that work?
So the relationship between incarceration rates and crime rates has been studied pretty extensively. And somewhat counterintuitively, most researchers who have looked at the question have concluded that actually the relationship between the two isn't as great as you might suspect. That rising incarceration rates, if they have any positive effect on reductions in crime, it only accounts for a very, very small fraction of the reduction. And that's mostly by taking really serious repeat offenders off the streets. With respect to less serious nonviolent offenders in particular, but even some violent offenders, there is some concern that incarceration may actually, in the long term, increase crime rates, in part because removing people from their communities often makes them worse and not better when they return to the communities, and also weakens the communities from which they come.
Right. There, I've heard generational concerns that if a lot of people in a community are incarcerated, they're not there in their community, raising the next generation, building the economy of that community. Do we see that kind of effect in the long run?
That certainly is a significant concern. And a number of states have actually in recent years significantly decreased their prison populations and seen a drop in their crime rates, not a rise as some would have expected.
Now, looking at how Wisconsin stacks up, a lot of people compare Wisconsin to Minnesota, similarly sized states, similar geographic region. Minnesota incarcerates a lot fewer people. I was looking at a chart of the nation. It looks like Wisconsin is in the middle when it comes to per capita incarceration. How does Wisconsin stack up overall?
So you're right that if we look at national trends, we're sort of in the middle. But if you compare us to our neighbors and look at Midwestern states more generally, we tend to be more punitive, even though our crime rates are not any higher than most of our neighbors. And in fact, there are concerns particularly about the size of our community supervision population. We tend to keep people on supervision for much longer than many states in the nation. And that leads to this contingent liability in which individuals can end up being revoked even for behavior that wouldn't have been criminal were they not on supervision.
We're talking to Cecilia Klingel from the UW Law School about what's driving an increase in Wisconsin's prison population. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think it should be a goal to reduce Wisconsin's prison population? Do you worry about the safety? Do you have safety concerns if we lower that prison population? What do you think about the growing portion of the state's budget that's going to pay for the prison population? And has this been part of your life? Have you been on this supervision system after getting released from prison? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. We continue our conversation about the criminal justice system and Wisconsin's growing prison population. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think our current system is working, making communities safer? If you've been a crime victim, what do you think of stricter sentencing rules? Or do you or someone close to you have experience going through this extended supervision system? What's that experience like? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Cecilia Klingel is with us, associate professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School. Cecilia, we focused in on one part of the equation, this extended supervision leading some people to end up back in prison. Let's talk about longer prison terms. I've heard concerns in the past that we're going to have a new specialty of geriatric incarceration. What are we seeing when it comes to people staying in prison late into their lives?
Well, it is certainly true that we're seeing a rising number of elderly prisoners, in large part because we don't have that parole release mechanism to shorten longer term sentences. In addition to just humanitarian concerns that many people have about incarcerating, particularly those elderly who are dying, there are concerns that are based in cost. It's very expensive to provide the health care that's necessary for aging prisoners. And we know that prisoners on the whole age more quickly than the general population. Many people in prison haven't received very good health care throughout their lives. They tend to have higher rates of chronic illnesses as well as mental illnesses that affect them significantly. And because of the way the federal Medicare and Medicaid systems are structured, states don't have access to those funds for people who are in public institutions. And that means that the state bears the full cost of providing constitutionally required health care for those individuals.
At the front end of the prison, the incarceration experience, a lot of people are talking about alternatives to incarceration programs that hopefully take that young offender in particular and keep them from being in the prison system on and off through their lives. Are there things that we know that work?
Sure, there are lots of things we know. And I think that despite working in the criminal justice system, I'd be remiss not to mention that the best interventions have nothing to do with criminal justice at all. We know that investing in early childhood education, supporting parents and families early in a child's development as the family is growing, is one of the best ways to provide the resources that children need to make good decisions, to further their education, and to position themselves to combat some of the high risk factors that are most strongly associated with engaging in criminal behavior.
Let's bring on a caller now. Ron is with us in Wausau. Ron, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I apologize. I haven't been listening for the entire hour. I just hopped in the car. But I come at this discussion from 28 years of law enforcement in the state of Wisconsin. And I think, first of all, I'm totally in favor of reducing the prison population. But I think it needs to be addressed rather than decriminalizing things or having less harsh sentences, more from a public health standard where we increase a lot of childhood education, increase childhood nutrition and childhood care and all those things, which can hopefully set people up for success in making positive decisions later in life that would hopefully avoid any sort of prison sentences and incarceration.
Ron, thanks a lot for the call. So there you have somebody who's been in law enforcement for over a quarter of a century agreeing with what you were just saying it's not a matter of just criminal justice.
No, and I think that's right, that often the criminal justice system is asked to step in when no one else knows what to do about a problem that needs to be solved. And it often is not the best positioned agency to deal with the kinds of problems we see. Increasingly, criminal justice systems are asked to be medical providers and mental health providers to deal with substance abuse issues and failures in educational systems. The criminal justice system isn't equipped to do that very well.
And mental health, you just mentioned. Are there efforts to provide mental health care in the setting of incarceration or instead of incarceration?
Yes, to both of those things. Our nation's jails and prisons are incontrovertibly the nation's largest mental health care providers. They're obliged to provide care for those who are identified as having mental health challenges. But that said, again, their ability to do that well is compromised by a number of factors, including the number of available providers.
I want to bring on another caller. Carly is on the line in Madison. Carly, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just called. My husband is actually going through this. He's on extended supervision, and I just kind of wanted to agree with what your speaker's saying, how a lot of the problems don't even have to do with, like, parole or dealing with that aspect, but it's more of being like reintegrated into society. So I feel like there needs to be an increased effort in getting people reintegrated. I mean, we've had a ton of trouble finding a job, getting an apartment, and things of that nature. And I also maybe had a question about how, like, Wisconsin's online DCAP system maybe affects people like this.
Carly, thanks a lot for the call. Good luck to your husband in finding a job and reentering society. Can you talk about some of the concerns she raised, Cecilia?
Sure. As Americans, we're really good at punishing and we're really bad at forgiving. We have lots of ways to hold people accountable for criminal behavior, but we don't have lots of ways for individuals who've really discharged their sentence to reintegrate successfully into the community. And there are lots of obstacles, both formal legal ones and informal stigmas, that make it very difficult for people to secure employment, housing, and a range of other benefits for their families.
And briefly, as we wrap up, are those shortfalls leading a lot of people back into prison?
Well, it certainly is leading some people back into prison, and I think we don't know enough about exactly what's causing some of those back-end failures. And I think there's a lot of research going on right now to try to identify and places where we can intervene and improve success throughout the system for everyone who's involved in it.
We'll leave it there for now. Cecilia, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Cecilia Klingel from the University of Wisconsin Law School. She was with us to talk about why new figures show Wisconsin's prison population at a record high. The most divisive item on the ballot this season in Mount Horeb isn't about candidates, it's about dogs. Residents will soon vote on whether to designate places that breed, sell, or use dogs or cats in research a public nuisance. Phoebe Petrovic reports on how this issue has divided the village.
It's just over 2 weeks before the election, and Jill Sweckel is outside with her basset hound, Reggie.
He's not all that smart in the department of what he puts in his mouth.
There's a sign on Sweckle's front lawn with a picture of a beagle that kind of looks like Reggie.
It says, "I'm not a science experiment."
Next door, there's a sign that says, "Animal research saves lives." Sweckle and her neighbor represent the two sides in Mount Horeb's binding referendum. The target is Ridgeland Farms, a beagle breeding and research facility. If the referendum passes, places like Ridgeland would become a public nuisance, like gambling devices or illegal drinking. The vote is largely symbolic. Ridgeland has a P.O. box in Mount Horeb, but the farm, where the dogs live, is in the next village over. Mount Horeb has been divided ever since a local activist group called Dane for Dogs started collecting signatures. There are signs on the front lawns, billboards on the highways, all in a village of fewer than 7,500 people. For residents like Sweckle, the issue is straightforward.
I just don't believe that we should be breeding animals in the thousands to be sent to experiments that really are antiquated and outdated.
But it's a clear choice for those who will vote against the referendum, too, like Susan Wallach.
I'm a cancer survivor, and about half my family have survived cancer. And I very firmly believe that the science that we needed to get to the point where we could treat cancer successfully came in part from animal testing.
Wallach has another reason for her vote. She's friends with some of the owners, like Jim Burns.
He's a veterinarian and has treated many, many of the animals in Mount Horeb over the years.
So she trusts that Ridgeland's dogs are treated well. And she says they're there for a purpose, to help medical progress. Many of today's drugs and treatments have come in part from animal testing. But mice and rats make up about 95% of all animals used in research. Dogs and cats make up less than 1%. But dogs are still used to study diseases we have in common, like cancer. Ridgeland says this research is essential. That's why they've mailed flyers to the whole village several times and bought ads in the weekly paper. Rick Van Dommelen is the farm's facility manager and vet. He's concerned the activists have a larger agenda.
Their goal is to end research worldwide, essentially, but they're going to start here.
But activists like Samantha Robbins say Van Dommelen is misrepresenting their campaign.
We're not saying, like, animals in general, we shouldn't test on them. We're saying dogs and cats we see differently as a society now. We see them as family, so we're not okay with treating them this way.
Tempers have flared over the issue and the tactics. Ridgeland supporters believe the local activists are coordinating with outside groups to shut down all research. And those activists think Ridgeland is slinging mud to protect their profits. But what the referendum really comes down to, says Dane for Dogs founder Rebecca Clem, are the 3,000 or so beagles at Ridgeland.
Less than 5 miles away from where we're sitting right now, there are thousands of dogs in stacked cages in windowless sheds with no access to sunlight, no access to grass.
Clem says those conditions are unethical, and that's what makes it a nuisance. But Van Dommelen could not disagree more.
I mean, saving lives, human and animal, is not a public nuisance at all. Absolutely not.
Village residents will soon decide for themselves whom they agree with, Ridgeland Farms or Dane for Dogs. But whatever happens in Mount Horeb, the activists say they'll get to work elsewhere in Dane County. Phoebe Petrovic, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, a quarter of American teens take medication to help them sleep, according to a new study. We'll find out why that has pediatricians worried. If you're feeling anxious, it might be time to do some cleaning. A Wisconsin psychologist tells us why housework makes some people a lot happier. And have you ever spent time in Pokerville, Oil City, or Jenkinsville? Probably not, because they're a few of the lost towns of Wisconsin. We'll take a tour of communities that faded away in the history of the state. I was looking at a list. They are all over in pretty much every county of the state. That and some of the top news of the day. It's all coming up Monday here on Central Time.